I think we left off on chapter 9. I think that's where I left off, because what I did is I juxtaposed you guys with my other Bible study, and then I realized that I did that. But I think we are on 9 verse 1. Does that sound right to everybody?
Is that right?
Kings.
Yes. Yeah, first not one. Okay.
Yes.
We're going to start chapter 9?
Yes. 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 1. Remember where we left off last week? Solomon had made that beautiful prayer to the Lord, and he talked to the people. It was just steeped in history. There was prophecy in it. It was just, you couldn't ask more from a leader. Okay, then we go to this, and it says, "Now it came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, his palace, and all that Solomon desired to do." Okay, we got to realize that that was a dedication of the temple, and this is now, because the temple began in the spring of 966 and finished in 959, dedicated 11 months after the completion in 958. The palace wasn't completed until 946. So you're looking at 12 years later. Okay, what we just left to this, 12 years later. And the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. Because remember, the Lord had just talked to him 12 years before, as he did at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, "I have heard your prayer." Okay, I want you to think about this. The prayer was made 12 years ago. God showed up and said, "Yeah, I was listening." This is God's time. This is, he does what he wants. He does it exactly when it's right. The prayer, what he's saying is, "I heard your prayer." That's the prayer that we read last week, 12 years before this. God shows up and says, "Yeah, I was listening. And your supplication, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house, which you have built, by putting my name there forever, and my ears and my heart will be there perpetually." This is kind of interesting, because the building isn't there perpetually. But what God is saying is, I'm always going to look here. This will always mean something to me, because I chose it to. It's just like Israel. Once again, and it makes you always wonder why, because you look at it, you go, really? This is the spot you chose to? Yeah. Because mostly I think it's because there is nothing there. It's how God works. It's why he chose Israel. Remember I said, God said, "I didn't choose you, Israel, because you were great and mighty. I chose you because you were small. You were the least." And I think that's just how he works. Because in less than 400 years, Babylon is going to come and destroy the temple. God's eye never left it. It's not so much the temple that he wasn't leaving. It was the place and the people. And it still matters him today. Even what we prayed for, which I forgot to pray for, which I should have prayed for. Deuteronomy 11 through 12. "But the land into which you are about to cross." Now, this is well before Solomon. This is, they had just left Egypt. They're still in the wilderness, and God tells them this. "To possess a land of hills and valleys, drinks water from the rains of heaven, a land from which your Lord cares." So even before they got there, God says, "It's just special to me." Why? Because I want to... Why is anything special to you? You don't know. It just is. It's just had a place in his heart. "The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning even to the end of the year." So what he's saying is 365, 24/7, it never loses my sight. I'm not ever not aware of what's going on there. Now, we as Christians can get a little squirrely with this. God doesn't really need us to do anything about this. What he's saying is, this is what I'm doing. Now, especially on the political end of Christianity, we can get very wrapped up in Israel, almost like Israel can do no wrong. And even at charge conference, this came up because the bishop made a decree and people got mad because they thought he was saying something bad about Israel. It's almost like we as Christians should defend Israel no matter what they do, because when we do that, we're defending God. Well, God never says you need to do that. God's saying, whatever you do, I'm going to do this. And if Israel does well, then we should back them. If they don't do well, we should tell them. That's the Christian way to do this. But what he's saying is, it's mine. I care about it. I chose to. And once again, the world revolves around that little hunk of desert with nothing in it. You know, people are still riding camels, and the world's fortune still turns on what happens there. It says, then it goes on in verse 4, as for you, I will, if you walk before me as your father David walked, in the integrity and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinance, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. This is a big promise, what he's saying to him. And this is maybe the third, fourth time God has said this. He shows up every 10 years, 5 years, and tells him this, just so you don't forget. He tells him the same thing. Brother, it's all yours. This is limitless if you just do the right thing. Well, we all know how hard the right thing is to do. When you know, if there is something you want more than God, it will show up. It's supposed to. It's what we're here for, to have it show up. And it does show up. But God's telling him, if you can do this, and it amazes me that he says, like your father David. We know some of the things that David did. Murdered someone, you know, adultery, just a myriad of things that David did. And he was still the best man walking the earth. So just keep that in perspective. But if you or your sons indeed turn away from me, following me, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and go to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated in my name, I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all people, which they eventually did. And this house will become a heap of ruins, which it eventually did. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, adopted other gods and worshipped them and served them before the Lord had brought all this. Therefore, the Lord brought all this adversity on them. if nothing else, I want you to understand, get a clear understanding of this is the criteria, which should give you an appreciation for grace. This is the law. This is what Jesus Christ came to set us free from. This is the standard of the law. If you do wrong, you're done. Jesus Christ came so that I could do wrong and not be done. You don't see anything like this in New Testament after Jesus Christ. You don't hear these dire warnings. This is what we owe to Christ. But you would never appreciate Christ. You would never understand. You wouldn't understand what grace is unless you knew what this was. This tells us what grace has done for us. I mean, we're not even looking at what's coming yet. This is just the warning. And the warning is true. Deuteronomy 29:24-29. All the nations will say, why has the Lord done this to the land? And every time I read you Deuteronomy, remember, this is hundreds and hundreds of years before this. These were things that God said hundreds and hundreds of years ago that he's saying again. Nothing's changed. This is all going this way. It's linear. It's going somewhere. It's heading somewhere. It's not this. I mean, the people are doing this, but God is doing this. He's just heading in a direction. He's heading to Jesus Christ. And so he says basically the same thing in Deuteronomy 12, Israel. Why this great outburst of anger? Then men will say, because they have forsook the covenant of the Lord, the God of their father, which he had made with them, and he brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they have not known and who they were not allotted to them. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and fury and great wrath and cast them into other lands as it is this day. Well, this was back in Deuteronomy, while they're still not in the land. It's about to happen. This is prophecy. I think that's the point I'm trying to say. God is, when he says this to Solomon, it's a reference back to what was said in Deuteronomy. He knows what's coming, and it's just the reminder. The point is, it's not random. It isn't bad luck. When this happens, which, as far as I'm concerned, it can happen. But he's saying this so that they know it's not random. It's not bad luck. Because every time it's God doing it, God tells you he's doing it. The Lord our prover, okay, it says, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of the law. I love that little sentence. What it's saying is there's a lot of things you don't know about God, but what he does tell you, pay attention to it. Pay real attention to it. It says it belongs to us. So once he tells it to you, you own it. And now, verse 10. It came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, 7 years for the temple, 13 years for the palace. Hiram, the king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber, the gold according to all his desires. When King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee, which is Jesus' place, where Jesus spent most of his time. So Hiram came out from Tyre, which is Syria, that's the best way to see this, to see the cities which Solomon had given him, and they did not please him. And he said, what are these cities which you have given me, my brother? Why are they called? That's why they are called the land of Kabul to this day, which I guess is an insult. This is interesting. If you remember way back, all that Hiram has done for Solomon, they have done everything together. It has just been a beautiful relationship. Supply and demand, giving them a good price, taking care of the craftsmen, all the stuff for the temple. This has worked out really well for both of them. They're both doing really well. And they are just hard, fast allies. Think of Reagan and Thatcher. You know what I mean? Just inseparable. And what he said to him is, because of everything you've done for me, I'm going to give you 20 cities. Well, in other words, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of land. He comes down and look at it and goes, dude, this stinks. And this whole thing is said again, and it's just neat that it's in here. And it's said again, I believe, in Chronicles, the whole thing. And it doesn't really give us the resolution here, but it says, and Hiram sent the king 120 talents of gold. So apparently it got worked out. I don't know if 120 was less than what was originally the part was. So this is not only just payment for what he's done, he's also, I'm going to give you these 20 cities for everything you've done for me, but you still have to give me X to make it square. Because apparently these 20 cities is a big time thing. So they figure it out. And by the way, there are two Hirams of Tyre. What are the odds? It's like two Bobs from Philadelphia. The other Hiram was a couple chapters back, and he was the craftsman. And remember I talked about how the guy made the big book for being really good at what he does, which is always motivation for what you do. God notices, you know, every one of these words and letters that is on these pages is precious. There's so much space, and everything that in there is just, it's the most valuable real estate in the world is these pages. And God took a couple of paragraphs of just about this guy who worked gold and stones, and just to make it be known, that's not this guy. This guy's the king. Okay. Now, this is the account of the forced labor which King Solomon levied to build the house of the Lord in his own house, the Milo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Megiddo should stand out to you. Does anybody know why Megiddo is important?
No.
A big one. End times. That's where the big battle is. Revelations. It's just perfect for war. I'll go on and read. The Milo, you'll see this mentioned quite a few times. There is the city of Jerusalem sits here. The palace and the temple sit here. And in between them is this ditch. Hard to call it a valley. The Milo is the thing they're filling it in. It's a public works project. Instead of having to go down and up, they said, why don't we just put some dirt in there and we could go straight across. Well, this is a huge undertaking. And you'll hear it several times in here. But this is one of the things he's doing through forced labor. Hazor is a city 10 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, which is important because it is the strong point in the north. It's the thing that protects them from the north. I mean, there are still other things in the north, but it's the big garrison. So what he's doing is he's fortifying his defenses up north. Megiddo is important because it guarded a really crucial pass near Mount Carmel. Many battles have been fought there. It's always the place where they get fought because it's a pinch point. As we have stated, it's the point where a lot of these things, where all these battles are going to end. Remember that place because something really, really important happens there. When that final battle where they come against Israel and they get wiped out by the hand of God, this is where it's going to happen. Gezer is 20 miles west of Jerusalem. It's a coastal plain. It's important because the coastal plain is where the food is. That's why they're always fighting with the Philistines. That's why they can't pry the Philistines out, because it's fertile. You can grow stuff there. It's not just a bunch of rocks and trees. For Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer, burned it with fire, and killed the Canaanites who lived in the city, and had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. That's why he is fixing Gezer, because here's what Dad did. What can I give my daughter? I'll give him Gezer. Let's go up and kill all them people, and we'll give it to her. Okay. That's what was done. He sent an army up. They wiped them out, and he said, hey, honey, this is for you. She said, thanks, Dad. Such is the world. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer and lower Beth Horon and Baalath and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah. You know, we say these things, these are huge undertakings. I mean, things are booming. Think of post-World War II. You know, when everything's up and running in World War II and then everybody comes home, everybody wants to build houses. I mean, it's just buzzing. Stuff is being built everywhere. It's just exploding. This is what is going on in Israel. It's kind of neat because even through all this, the people of Israel really aren't doing the work. And all the storage cities which Solomon had, even the cities of his chariots and his cities of horsemen, and all that has pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and all the land under his rule. As for the people who were left of the Amorites, Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not the sons of Israel, in other words, the people that were living under their control, that were, yeah, the people of Palestine, their descendants who were left there after them in the land whom the sons of Israel were unable to utterly destroy, from them Solomon levied forced labor even to this day. In other words, they enslaved them. They said, you're doing the work. Now, Exodus, this is interesting about slavery and why he enslaved them. Exodus 21, 1 through 11. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, and on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons and daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to the master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man. Then his master shall bring him to God, and they shall bring him to the door of the doorpost, door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Now, this is kind of interesting. This is so far detached from us. I can't even comprehend this. What this is saying is, you can never permanently own a slave of your own people. Israel worked on a 7-year cycle, an economic cycle. Everything worked on it. If you took a loan, it depended, paying it back was where you were on the 7-year cycle, because all the books get wiped clean after 7 years. So if I borrow $100 from Roland and I borrow it in the 6th year, that means my payments have to be figured for 12 months. If I borrow it in the 1st year, then I've got 7 years of payments. That way, the purpose of this is always so someone can always go free. You can never be a slave longer than 7 years. You can never take anyone's land longer than 7 years. So that monopolies don't occur. So every family, and there could be things and reasons why you need to sell. Okay, 4 years left in the cycle. Horrible things have happened. We fell into big problems. Somebody says, you know what, I'll pay you for your land for 4 years. Okay, at the end of those 4 years, you get your land back so that you always have the means of producing wealth. Because in this place, wealth is produced usually by producing food. The land produces wealth. It's not to the point where labor produces wealth. We haven't got there yet. Then it gets interesting, because then we get to women. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eye of her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall not let her be redeemed. He shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. So in other words, if she becomes his, he has to be fair. He can't just exchange. Yeah, it's been 2 years. Get out of here. He can't do that. And if he picks her for his son, then she's a daughter. All the rights and all the things that the scriptures say, that the way you treat a daughter, then, in other words, these rules are to stop Israel from hurting Israel. Because without these rules, they will. And you will see that they found ways to bend these rules, as always. The loopholes. They created them. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he will not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Remember, he paid for her, so something is expected in return. This is also extremely foreign to us. I can't imagine this. I have a daughter. This is just bizarre to me. But when you consider this has to do with survival. This has to do with keeping her alive. I mean, it's not like today. I mean, you could starve. I mean, people starve. So this all has to do with survival and getting by. But what God says is, I want you to do these things right. Now, this takes us back to a much misunderstood verse where they come to Jesus and they say to him, how does God feel about divorce? And God says, he quotes scripture. He says, God hates divorce. Well, who doesn't? Yeah, I mean, it's a hard, nasty thing. But what God is saying is, you know, I hate it. Now, he's given reasons for it. He says, then why does God allow a man to dismiss his wife with a certificate of divorce? And Jesus says something really spectacular. He says, because your hearts are so hard that you're not listening to the first command. So what I'm making you do, and this is the summary of it, what I'm making you do by doing this is doing the wrong thing right. You shouldn't be divorcing her, but if you're going to do it, I will not permit you to leave her destitute, to just forget about her, use her and throw her away. I will not allow you to do that. So that's Jesus' answer back to them. This is us. This is why these rules are here. And this is why Solomon is using the foreigners. Because all these rules exist with using people from Israel. There are no such rules with heathens. But Solomon did not make, verse 22, but Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel, for they were men of war, his servants, his princes, his captains, his chariots, commanders, and horsemen. In other words, they were doing the good jobs. They were doing the cool stuff. And they could he could trust them. These were the chief officers over whom over Solomon's work, 550, who ruled over the people doing the work. So even these indentured servants, even these slaves, he put 500 people of Israel over that entire workforce, split up, you know, over foremen is the best way to put it. As soon as Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon built for her, he built the Milo. Now three times in a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he built to the Lord, burning incense upon them on the altar which was before the Lord. So he finished the house. Now that seems like a strange little caveat. Like, okay, and then you move on to the next thing. Well, that's important. Deuteronomy 16:16-17. Three times in a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in a place which he has chosen, which is now the altar where he did it, the place where he has chosen. Oh, Kevin had found a really good answer. Remember I asked the question last time, I don't understand in Israel how they no longer sacrifice. If you don't believe that Christ is the supreme sacrifice, how did they stop sacrificing animals for forgiveness of sins? I know they have a justification for it, but what is it? I don't know. And I think Kev found out online that it's because what it just said here, and the place he has chosen, the place that God had chosen, which is the temple site, is no longer available, so they cannot sacrifice. Is that the gist of what you found?
Right.
What you told me?
Essentially, spiritually illegal to do any sacrifice until such time that that place was.
And the reason it's illegal, because of what I just read, in the place he has chosen, which is the temple site. So what they're saying is, if we're not at the temple site, which is now a Muslim mosque, we can't do it. Okay.
And the funny part was, I didn't even look for it. We were just listening to NPR, and it came on. And it was like right after Jeff had talked about it. I was like, okay.
I think I'm more amazed that you're listening to NPR than I did. Oh, okay.
What's wrong with NPR?
Nothing. Nick Danger. You ever listen to Danger? Okay, never mind. I digress.
I'm more of a Car Talk guy. Although that's gone now, isn't it?
Fireside Theater? You never... Oh, okay. Dude, that's funny stuff. Anyway. Okay, in the names of the feast. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of the Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. No matter who you are, show up and make sacrifices 3 times a year. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which has given you. This is cool, because what's neat about this is it leaves it to you to decide how much you were blessed. It's much like how we give offerings now. In the old days, that 10% was hard and fast. You know, there were offerings that you gave as an offering. Then there was your tithe, which was hard and fast. We don't do that anymore. We do this. You know, hey, ponder it. How much has the Lord blessed you? Return that. Whatever you think it is. Exodus 23:14-17. 3 times in a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of the unleavened bread for 7 days. You are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you. And at the appointed time in the month of Abib, in which you came out of Egypt, and none of you shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the feast of the harvest, the feast of the first fruits of your labors, from that which you have sowed in the field. Also the feast of, boy, in gatherings at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruit of your labors of the field. 3 times in a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. Now, if the only place you can make this is at the temple, what's this mean? 3 times a year, there's a massive migration of every male that comes to Jerusalem, and there's a lot of blood shed. There's dead stuff everywhere. And once again, realize these are parties, but these are leave your wives at home parties. It's a good party. It's like a, yeah, it's a, all the males, and they're going, okay, honey, you're not allowed to come to a party, God said. And I guess they could bring them, but they weren't supposed to be part of this sacrifice stuff. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber, which is near Eloth, and on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent his servants with the fleet, sailors who knew the sea, along with the servants of Solomon, and they went to Ophar and took 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to King Solomon. That is a massive amount of gold. I mean, just massive. Now, 2 Chronicles says it's 450. So somewhere somebody did some counting that, you know, 30 talents of gold is somewhere where we're not quite sure where it's at. How are we doing on time here? Yeah, we'll start this. Chapter 10. This is something that most of us are aware of. It's a very short passage, and I didn't check the Chronicles to see if it was mirrored. There may be more. But it just seems amazingly famous for such a small little ditty. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large, I don't know what that is, retinue. With camels, I guess that's a
caravan,
that's what I thought, yeah. With camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. And she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. Solomon answered all of her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. The Queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the attendants of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers, his stairways by which he went up to the house of the Lord, and there was no more spirit in her. In other words, she was a rich lady. She showed up because she had heard he was rich, and when she looked at all of it, she went, oh my goodness, you know, I'm not rich, he's rich. She looked at it and said, oh my, this is so far beyond anything that I even thought was even possible. In other words, her pride of what she had was gone. Then she said to the king, it is a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I didn't believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told to me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the reports which I heard. How blessed are your servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delights in you to set you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord loved Israel forever. This is not a Hebrew saying this. This is a foreigner saying this. Therefore, he made you king to do justice and righteousness. So what she says is, after she gushes on about his wealth, she says, how lucky you guys are to stand here in the court and hear him talk. She says, do you understand how fortunate you are? This is how smart the guy is. I mean, she says every question she had. Now think about all the questions you've accumulated in your life, the things you don't understand, the things you want to know. She brought them all. He answered every one of them and answered them totally and completely and satisfied. It is the wisdom of the Lord. She gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great amount of spices and precious stones. Never again did such an abundance of spices come in as such as the queen of Sheba gave King Solomon. Also the ships of Hiram, which brought gold to from Ophir, brought in from Ophir a very great number of almug trees and precious stones. I don't know what they are, but they're obviously something rare. The king made the almug trees support the house of the Lord and for the king's house. Also lyres and harps for singers. Such almug trees have not come in again, nor have they been in the city to this day. King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all her desire, which she requested, besides what had given her according to the royal bounty. Then she turned and went to her own land together with her servants. Now the weight of the gold which came into Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, at 120 pounds a talent. My ciphron came out to 78,920 pounds of gold. When you break that into ounces, current prices of $1,700 an ounce, $1,630,000,000, that's just the gold in 1 year that just came in. So King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold using 600 shekels of gold on each large shield, 20 pounds. They weren't gold shields. They were shields that were covered with 20 pounds of gold. He made 300 shields of beaten gold using 3 minas, which is 1.2 pounds each, of gold on each shield. These are much smaller shields, and put them in the king's forest. You know, a pound and a quarter of gold is a lot of money. He had 300. They just put them in the shields and he hung them up. They're not doing anything. You know what I mean? They're decoration. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with refined gold. There were 6 steps to the throne, on a round top of the throne at its rear, and the arms on each side of the seat, and 2 lines standing beside the arms. Okay, think of this, and it's all covered in gold. 12 lions were standing there on 6 steps on one side and on the other. Nothing like it was made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. It was not considered valuable. For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish and the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years of Tarshish came bringing gold, silvery, ivory, apes, and peacocks. They'd go out on these reconnoitering for 3 years all around the Mediterranean, picking up everything they could find of interest and bringing it back. And they would, hey, the ship's coming, let's go see what we got. All the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his heart. They brought every man his gift, articles of silver, gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses, mules, so much year by year. Now Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen. He stationed them in the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem, and he made cedar as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowlands. Also, Solomon imported horses from Egypt and Kew, and the king's merchants procured for them from Kew for a price. A chariot was imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. And remember, silver is incidental. And by the same means, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Amorites. So what he's saying is they bought low, they sold high, and they were just making money hand over fist. There was nothing stopping them. Happy days are here again. It is just the roaring 20s. It's just no matter what you did, it prospered. You could not make money. And then I'll leave you with the first verse of chapter 11. I want you to understand how good things are. They're not at war with anybody. We read this before. Remember, it says each man sat underneath his grapevine in peace. In other words, life was good. You know, you're just sitting there watching your stuff grow. You harvest it when it comes in. Your family's doing well. Your kids aren't being killed in war. The hard work's being done by somebody else. Money is everywhere. It's just, they're bringing peacocks in. They're borrowing boats from the King of Tyre to go look for peacocks because they just don't know what else to do with their money. You know, let's go get some of the pretty birds. You know, then chapter 11, verse 1. There's a problem with vast wealth and no worries. This is the same thing that happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. I know I've told you guys a few times, but never forget this, that I think it's Isaiah that tells us this is what happened to Sodom. She became so wealthy that she turned it all inwards, and she didn't care for the poor. She didn't take care of the business she should have. We always think of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we think of their debauchery and their sexual sin. That was all just the expression of their turning everything inward. That's what comes out of that. The real sin was me. Okay. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. These were all people, they weren't allowed to have these women for wives. Expressly forbidden. Deuteronomy 17:17. You shall not multiply. Oh, by the way, I read this to you once before. This is the order for the king. It says, when you get to Israel and when you appoint a king, these are the orders for that king. It's what he, remember we read, and it says, he shall read this, you know, every week. He shall read these rules so that he doesn't forget them. One more time. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Apparently, he stopped reading this. Nehemiah 13:23-28. In those days, this was before, Nehemiah is after Solomon. In those days, I saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, the same place Solomon did. Nehemiah is saying that Nehemiah, they were taken into exile. I think it's Nebuchadnezzar that allows them to come back and start to rebuild things. This is a great thing. Go ahead back to your land. Then Nehemiah sees this happening. Okay, some people came back and they're starting to do it right off the bat. And he goes, as for their children, half spoke the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. In other words, what he's saying is our culture was destroyed. He said the children of Israel don't speak Israeli anymore. They don't speak Hebrew. They're speaking all these because of the foreign wives. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations, there was no king like him. And he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all of Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Do we not hear about you, and you have committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Joadiah, the son of Ilabish, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanabat the Horonite. So I drove him away from me. What he's saying is, this is such an important thing, this event right here, that it was foretold before, and afterwards it's used as an example. And even in Nehemiah's case, what he's saying is, even the chief priest's son is doing this. Nehemiah is a madman. They're all thinking this guy's nuts. And he's going, I'm not nuts. Because if Solomon, in all of his greatness, fell because of this, who do you think you are that you can stand? That's what he's saying. And in verse 2, from the nations concerning which the Lord said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your hearts away from their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. and his wife turned his heart away. One wife can turn your heart away. A thousand of them, none of them have the values that he has. You can relate this to marrying, I guess, in some sense, a non-believer. The same problems come up where you think, I'll marry them and I'll turn them. It's not, it doesn't work that way. The New Testament scripture is pretty clear. What does the light have to do with the darkness? Do not be unequally yoked. And it is the grace version of the same command. In other words, do you want something more than you want me? And you respond, well, Lord, you made them that way. They're almost unavoidable. I mean, look at what you made. You did a good job. You know, why'd you make them so good looking if you can't? And God's saying, I made them good looking so you would have to choose. I know exactly what I'm doing. And he didn't just violate the law. He blew right through it and act like a thousand of them. And this is the beginning of this brief unified kingdom that lasted for three kings. It's the beginning of the end. This is what did it. So no matter how, and he was the wisest man that ever lived. And once again, men and their problems with women, there's something men want more than they want to obey God. This exposes it. Does it make women evil? By no means. They're doing what they were designed to do. Show us what's wrong with us. If you do it right, it's such a blessing. It's such a wonderful thing. And I ask you once again, every time we read where somebody had more than one wife, what came of it? Every time we read it. You know, it goes from, maybe those of us who've been married for a long time can look at this and understand that when you're not married and you see that he has a thousand wives, you go, oh boy. When you've been married for quite a while and you see he has a thousand wives, you go, oh boy. It's the same response, but you understand what the issue is. Nothing wrong with women. It's what's wrong with us. And men have fallen throughout the entire script. If you can't learn from this, it's everywhere. It's pervasive. Abraham, Samson, any of them, they all fell to the same thing. Lust. It's just what it is. Almost like we pretend that, well, it's so big we can't fight it. God's, oh, dude, you're going to stand in front of me and try that line? It's not going to fly. We'll leave there, and we'll pick up next week. Let's pray.